www.ee.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Tigers and the Brewers both have fallen on vile days, as have the Texas Rangers and the Tampa Devil Rays. The Padres, Mets, and Marlins are likewise prone or prostrate. Though it's still June, they probably feel it's getting awfully late. Meanwhile, the Yankees and the Giants and, good Lord, the Cubs are looking down for help from all the stinking, sinking clubs. Here to help us sort through the haves who will soon have more, as well as those who have not much and probably will soon have much less, is Tim Kirkchian of ESPN. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. In the American League, Seattle is the first-place team with the largest lead. Are the Mariners ready this time around to take the one step they haven't taken yet and win a championship?
I think they can, Bill, and I say that about a bunch of teams in Major League Baseball this year, and that's the beauty of this season. I think parity, if that's the right word, has arrived, and a lot of teams have a chance to go to the playoffs, and those who get there have a chance to go and win the World Series. That's great. Seattle had a great spring training, and they got off to a great start, and they really haven't slowed down. And they've done it in a way that is very encouraging for Mariner fans because they found a couple of kids along the way, including Gil Mesh, who was an injured player and has basically come back to prominence after being a big-time prospect. So despite, you know, some things that have gone wrong there, they found some young kids out of all this. And I really, really like the looks of that team at this point. And, yes, they can win that division. And, again, any team that goes to the playoffs in the American League this year, I think can get to the World Series.
Atlanta, which appeared to be at the end of a very successful era a while back, now seems to be in command again. I think they had a rebuilding week in there or something. But anyway, the Braves lead the National League and win, same as it ever was?
Bill, they didn't rebuild in a week. They rebuilt in like 3.5 days, and I'm not exaggerating. It is amazing, absolutely amazing what they did. They basically lost 70% of their pitching staff, which was the best pitching staff in the National League. They rebuilt it so quickly. But what they're doing is they are outslugging everybody this year, which I think, if I were a Braves fan, would be very encouraging. Their pitching isn't as good as it's been, but maybe that's a good thing. Maybe they're not going into the playoffs saying, well, our starting pitching will carry us. Don't worry about it. That's all that has to happen. And then when one of those great starting pitchers gets hit around, everyone says, oh, no, what are we going to do now? Now they have more ways to win a game, and that's a good thing for the Braves.
Tim, since last we spoke, Barry Bonds has become the only player ever to accumulate 500 home runs and 500 stolen bases as well. I've heard a lot of folks say that nobody else will ever reach that plateau. Why not?
Well, a lot of reasons. First off, as you know, Bill, he's not only the only 500-500, he's 600-500. No one else is 400-400, and only other guys are 300-300. I mean, he's gone to areas, obviously, where nobody else has gone, and no one else will go for one very important reason. The stolen base is basically dead today, and I don't think it's ever coming back to life. Today's game is built on hitting home runs and scoring as many runs as you can, and the fact that, you know, the risk of just trying to advance 90 feet, the risk of being thrown out, just isn't what it used to be. And that's why nobody, in my mind, is going near 500-500.
Barry's team, the Giants, are battling the Dodgers at the top of the National League's Western Division. There are those of us, Tim, who remember the New York-Brooklyn days and feel that the best seasons all feature confrontations like this one. Which of those two teams is best equipped to thrive from here on in?
Well, I like the Giants over the Dodgers, and let's, of course, not leave out the Diamondbacks of this equation. However, I'm just not sure the Dodgers are going to hit enough to win that division. We've talked about what an unbelievable offensive era we're in now, and this Dodger team is the lowest scoring team in the National League by far. No team has ever finished last in its league in scoring and gone on to the playoffs. And this team just isn't even close to being a good enough offensive team. Now, they can pitch their way to a lot of good things, but eventually they're going to have to score more than 3.6 runs per game, especially when Toronto in the other league is scoring 6.2 runs per game. It's just not enough. They recently won, had a 12-win streak in which they didn't score more than 5 runs in any of the 12 wins. That's the first time any team has done that in 11 years, and that was before this remarkable offensive era began.
Florida Marlins pitcher Dontrell Willis will not be pitching in meaningful games this fall. At least he probably won't. But he's got South Florida fans excited about their team for the first time since 1997 when they won it all. Is he that good? Or are Marlins fans willing to cheer for anything at this point?
No, he's that good, Bill. And he's also that much fun to watch. He has the strangest delivery just about you'll ever see. It's kind of a cross between Louis Tiant, Vida Blue, and Juan Marichal, and he's pitching like all three of those guys, and it's amazing. He's all arms and legs. He looks like a man who's falling out of a tree when he throws, and he's disguising the ball, meaning nobody can see where the ball's coming out. You see all these appendages coming at you, and then all of a sudden, pow, here comes the ball at 92 miles an hour. And the amazing part is, for as young as he is and as strange a delivery as he has, he throws an awful lot of strikes. He's not just a good young pitcher. He's become a phenomenon, in not just in South Florida, but all across Major League Baseball. He is now the leader for Rookie of the Year in that league, and he's going to make the All-Star team because he's the kind of guy that baseball needs to sell.
ESPN's Tim Kirkjian joins me from time to time to talk of baseball. Tim, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
It's Tuesday afternoon, a few hours before the Detroit Tigers, by any measure the least successful team in Major League Baseball this summer, will take the field to play the Red Sox at Fenway Park. For those who follow the Tigers, suspense is lacking.
It's not as bad as you would think, mainly because I'm used to it.
Gene Guidi of the Detroit Free Press sits in the sun behind the visitors' dugout and muses on better days.
Funny, the first year I covered was 1984, which was probably the best year to cover.
And all he did was win it all.
Right, and it's been pretty much downhill since then. I was told once by an old-time baseball writer that you either want to cover a real good team or a real bad team.
You don't want that 500 team.
No, because they're pretty vanilla. Of course, I shouldn't say that. It's been so long since we had a 500 team in Detroit that maybe it would be fun to cover one of those once in a while.
It won't happen for Gene Guidi this summer. 500? The Tigers currently aren't playing 300 ball. They started the season 0-9 and 1-16, and they've endured 5 losing streaks running to 6 games or more. Under these circumstances, it's not easy for Tigers manager Alan Trammell to accentuate the positive, but provoked, he'll give it a try.
Well, I think our pitching, to be honest with you, to start with, I think no one, including myself, would have thought that at this point in the season, you know, almost 3 months into it, that we would be pitching and holding the other team down as often as we have. And if we could look and kind of dream and fast forward this thing until when the season's over and look at, say, well, you know what, we've developed some pitching here, which is the number one component in baseball, then we're going to be a little bit closer to where we want to get to in the future.
Well, maybe. But Alan Trammell has to look beyond the statistics to reach that conclusion. Perhaps in large part because the Tigers are hitting about .220 as a team, Detroit's staff currently includes 3 pitchers on a pace to lose 20 or more games this season, and only one, rarely used comebacking reliever Steve Avery, with a winning record. Avery began his career 13 years ago as an Atlanta Brave, and he does have a veteran story to tell the unfortunate Detroit starters, slogging along with records like 2-11 and 1-10.
We almost lost 100 games my first year in Atlanta, and then we're in Game 7 of the World Series the next year. So, I mean, it's something that can turn around pretty quick, and they got the right attitude in here. They work hard, and, you know, really that's all you can do when you're young.
The capacity for hard work is important, obviously, but so is experience, a component that's in short supply on the Tigers roster. In the clubhouse before Tuesday night's game, Jack Morris, who won 198 games for the Tigers between 1977 and 1990 and now broadcasts their games on TV, tells a collection of young Detroit pitchers how the game works. He says that when he was a rookie, the umpires never gave him a call against a veteran hitter, but when he'd been around for a while, Morris would throw the same pitches for strikes against rookie hitters. Later, in the dugout, he explains what he was trying to get across.
Don't be shocked when you're young and you don't get the call, whether you're a hitter or a pitcher, because that's part of the game. And overall, I think the best thing you can do is not do anything and just make the next pitch in the same spot and challenge them again, because, you know, it's a tough game. We got a bunch of young kids that are experiencing something that they probably never experienced. And
Namely losing.
Losing and playing at a level that they haven't played at before. And, you know, if all of us can give some kind of advice and tell them, hey, we've been there before, we understand what you're going through, then it might help them relax and play with the ability that God gave them.
Advice may help. Experience will certainly help. According to some observers of the Tigers over the past several years, it wouldn't hurt if the team could stop wasting its draft picks either. But besides being a tough game, as Jack Morris says it is, baseball is also an impatient game, at least at the big league level. Teams that lose a lot, no matter why, tend to shed their managers. When Alan Trammell, himself a successful, durable, and very popular shortstop in Detroit for 20 years, was hired to manage the club, Tigers fans were delighted. But with people characterizing his club as perhaps the worst in baseball since the 1962 Mets lost 120 games, is Trammell wondering how long even a charter member of the Tiger family can keep his job?
At this point, I mean, I don't think that way. I'm very confident in my ability, and I think we all knew coming in what our record was going to be. Nobody has a crystal ball. Granted, we'd like it to be better, but you know what? I don't worry about that. I'm very confident, as I just mentioned, and you know, that's always an organization and owner's right, and as it should be.
Things got a little worse for the Tigers Tuesday night. They lost to Boston 10-1. The next night, they lost 11-2, and the following afternoon, they lost again 6-4. Alan Trammell was ejected by the home plate umpire in that one, and then, much to the dismay of the Red Sox, the Tigers left town. It's 18 minutes past the hour.
Everybody come see the greatest show. Got the rep all gigolos in row.
Ye old Royal Oak Inn, Wetton, in the English Midlands, was the site of a fearsome competition in toe wrestling last weekend. Landlord Brian Robothan presided as Natalie Cartwright of Nantwich, Cheshire, took the women's title, and Paul Beach of Burton-on-Trent vanquished various Australians, Germans, and Canadians, who, said Mr. Robothan, weren't very good. The British competitors have dominated in toe wrestling ever since 1976, when some regulars at Ye Olde Royal Oak Inn determined that they would invent the sport. This year's competition saw the unlikely toppling of Alan Nasty Nash as men's champion and halted at 4, the string of championships accumulated by Karen Kamikaze Davies.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's interleague play, the Cubs darned the Sox 4-3. Philadelphia doubled up Baltimore 4-2. Cleveland blanked Cincinnati 3-0. Arizona topped Detroit 8-3. And Boston scored 14 runs in the first inning against Florida on their way to a 25-8 win. Elsewhere, the Yankees downed the Mets 6-4. Toronto beat Montreal 6-5. And in the day's only intra-league game, Pittsburgh vanquished Colorado 5-3. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a visit to one of schoolyard basketball's legendary homes, Rucker Park. But first, it is the issue that will not go away. New tests, dire warnings, even deaths haven't convinced some athletes to eschew the pursuit of better performance through chemistry. In the current ESPN The Magazine, there is an article that focuses on a man who would eliminate the drugs, steroid tester Don Catlin, and one known to purvey chemical cocktails to athletes, among others, William Llewellyn. The author of that article, Sean Assale, joins me by phone now from New York. Sean, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's always a pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
It was, I would imagine, easy to find Don Catlin. He's on the record as the guy who tests for the NFL, the NCAA, and the U.S. Olympic Committee. But how hard was it to find William Llewellyn, a guy who's a self-described maker of designer steroids?
Actually, Bill, it was easier to find William Llewellyn than it was Don Catlin. William Llewellyn is really all over the internet with the supplements that he sells, and he's not trying to hide. He wants to be, you know, the number one supplement marketer in the nation. Right now, he's still a small guy, but, you know, he wants you to find him. Don Catlin, on the other hand, works behind smoke glass doors that are locked 24/7 on a side street in Los Angeles. So it's actually a bit of the reverse.
Now, we should mention that William Llewellyn's products are not illegal, thanks to a loophole or perhaps several loopholes in the drug laws.
That's right. What the law that was called the Dietary Health and Supplement Act of 1994 did was exempt a certain category of supplements from the laws that govern prescription drugs. And that was supposed to exempt things that contain, you know, ginseng and herbs and other quote-unquote natural health aids. Through a quirk in the law, a couple of wily chemists managed to sneak steroids into that loophole, and what Congress otherwise intended to be illegal became suddenly and very vexingly legal.
Llewellyn makes a surprising assertion in your article. At least it was surprising to me. He holds up a book containing research on more than 500 steroids, and he suggests that drug tests, as presently constituted, would only find about 50 of them. Is that correct?
Bill, I was blown away by that. And you're sitting there and you don't quite feel the force of it until he holds the book up in the air and sort of runs the pages together. And it takes a full 10 or 15 seconds to actually run through all the pages. And you realize that the first flush of steroid research was done in the 50s and 60s when drug companies were really cranking out the stuff in their labs, trying to sort of find medical uses for steroids. By 1970, that research had kind of become, if not quite disgraced, at least fallen out of favor. So really, there were only a very small number of steroids that became commercially viable. Hundreds upon hundreds more simply stayed in the lab, never released. And that's what Bill Llewellyn talks about when you talk about the sports underground. These are the people trying to recover those steroids from the past, and those are the steroids that there are really no drug tests for.
Most of the reports on steroids suggest that athletes and the folks who supply them with supplements are so far ahead of the drug testers that only the stupid get caught. I was surprised to read that Catlin has a somewhat more optimistic view.
Yeah, I mean, I think Don Catlin feels like he'll catch you, that he's a more than just a researcher. He's something of a molecular detective. He takes great pride in this, and he's been at the forefront of this for 20 years. Here's the problem, Bill. He only has the NFL as a pro sports client. Baseball, the NBA, and the NHL do not use him by choice. And I think it's reasonable to read something into that, that simply they don't want to use him.
They don't want their guys caught.
That's right.
Catlin has had some unexpected successes, though. Just a year after journals pointed to the emergence of a new drug, he had a test in place at the Salt Lake City Olympics, and I understand that some of the athletes he caught were very surprised.
Oh, it's a great story, Bill. And this is where you see that this becomes a game of cat and mouse between chemists. And it really is a game behind the game. And as I write in my piece, you know, Don Catlin is as ambitious and as competitive as any all-star that he tries to chase. And he knew the signs were there that a year earlier that a new generation blood doping drug was in the pipeline, was already in clinical trials in Europe, and had probably already filtered into the sports underground. He also knew that nobody thought he'd be able to get a test for it in time because there had never been a test done that quickly. But what he did is created what had amounted to a molecular SWAT team, and in 11 months of round-the-clock work, actually developed a test for darbepoetin, the drug that was the successor to EPO. He doesn't tell anybody, and he comes to Salt Lake really, cloak and dagger, not wanting to tip his hand. And it took him until the last day of competition, but he nailed three cross-country skiers. And as a result, two golds had to be given back. And really, the Olympic Village just had its breath taken away. It's really high-stakes drama, politics, and theater.
Catlin and Llewellyn agree that legislation currently under consideration to close the natural substance loophole in the supplement law won't change very much of how people are behaving. Were you surprised to find out that these two guys agreed on anything?
Yes, I think I was, Bill, but maybe not after I had spent time with both of them. I mean, they're really on different divides of the same world. They respect one another's ingenuity, and I think, quite interestingly, neither one watches sports. You want to know why? Because they can't watch the game. They're too busy obsessing on what they think people are taking. It's just a strange and curious occupational hazard. Was I surprised that they both agree? No. The fact of the matter is that these supplements are legal because they're weak versions of the illegal thing. Mm-hmm. As both will tell you, these supplements are really for the guy who in the gym who wants to fill out his Armani suit a little bit better. And Bill Llewellyn won't tell you this. There's even questions as to whether supplements work. The real stuff in sports are those illegal steroids in the book that are trafficking in the sports underground and other things like human growth hormone and even more powerful blood doping drugs. So I think that they feel like this supplement bill, while perhaps necessary, is still something of a sideshow.
Sean Assale's article appears in this week's edition of ESPN, the magazine. Sean, thanks once again for joining me.
Oh, anytime, Bill. It was a pleasure.
This year's Rucker Park tournament is underway, and it'll run through August. For more than 30 years, Rucker Park in Harlem has been home to some of the finest playground basketball in the nation, named after a New York City parks worker who started a summer basketball league in the late 1940s. The storied park has been celebrated in movies, rap songs, and now a new book on the history of the Rucker tournament. John Kalish reports from the asphalt in Harlem.
Holcomb Rucker was a World War II veteran who became a teacher and recreation supervisor. In 1946, he started organizing playground basketball tournaments in Harlem. Vincent Malazzi grew up in Harlem and now works as a sports editor at the New York Times. He's the author of a just-published history of the Rucker basketball tournament entitled Asphalt Gods.
He spent 16, 17, 18 hours a day even in the parks. And even if you didn't play basketball, you went to Holcomb Rucker for advice. He became, a guidance counselor in a striped shirt with a whistle. You know, that's pretty much what he was all about.
Malazzi's book credits Holcomb Rucker with helping hundreds of disadvantaged Harlemites earn college scholarships and finding homes for some 150 basketball players in pro or semi-pro leagues. Bob McCullough is one of them.
Rucker used to visit the schools. I saw him in my junior high school. I saw him in the hallway. I said, Rucker, what you doing here? He said, checking up on you. I said, hey, Rucker, I see you see him in school. I'm doing all right.
McCullough went on to a successful college hoops career and played in the ABL. He's now the director of the National Association of Each One Teach One, which continues the work of Holcomb Rucker in New York, Newark, Buffalo, and Louisville. At its peak in the late 1960s and early 70s, the Rucker League had high school, college, and pro divisions. Tony Greer, a Harlem native who was an All-American in college, played during that time.
If you played in the Rucker, that was the epitome of basketball, okay? If you earned your stripes, so to speak, there, you were certified, if I can use that word, okay? You could play.
In the 1960s and 70s, a slew of NBA superstars graced the asphalt at Rucker Park to work on their games in the off-season. Vincent Malazzi says there's another reason Rucker appealed to the pros.
Word was out on the street that some of the great players who'd never made it to the NBA were playing here. Joe Hammond, Pee Wee Kirkland, Herman the Helicopter Knowings, Jumpin' Jackie Jackson, the list goes on and on, of players who never made it to the NBA but who were great basketball players in their own right. That's what really brought droves and droves of pros here in the early 70s when this place was really the epicenter of basketball in the nation.
Malazzi's book tells what is at times the tragic story of the woulda, coulda, shoulda players who didn't make it to the NBA despite their enormous talent. Some did drugs, some did time, some just declined to play in the NBA. And some, like Pee Wee Kirkland, served time in prison and then dedicated themselves to working with young people. Kirkland, now 58, still gets a thrill remembering his days at Rucker Park in the late 60s and early 70s.
The crowd was magnanimous in the sense that no place in the world have I ever seen a crowd have the effect they have on a player. I mean, when I came to Rucker, it was almost like just listening to the crowd took me
to a level I'd never been to before in my life. You couldn't be a basic ball player, you couldn't be an ordinary ball player, and you couldn't be a one-dimension ball player. In order to get the respect that you wanted to get, you had to be a phenomenal ball player.
There are Rucker legends about Will Chamberlain dunking from the foul line and jumping Jackie Jackson taking coins off the top of a backboard. One game that people still talk about took place in the summer of 1966. Tony Greer and the Rucker All-Stars battled Philadelphia's best asphalt hoopsters, which included a college player nicknamed Black Jesus, who later gained fame on the New York Knicks as Earl the Pearl Monroe. Greer guarded Monroe that day and won the game's MVP award. People still stop him and reminisce about the game.
When I was a parole officer, I was down in Center Street, and I'm riding up in the elevator. And one of the lawyers turned to me and said, I know who you are. I remember watching you play in the Rucker. I passed by derelicts in the street, and it, yo, Tony, man, you still playing ball? I remember what you did against the Pearl. And it's amazing, you know, how many people come up and mention that game.
The other legendary Rucker game took place in the summer of 1971. That Rucker championship game pitted Pee Wee Kirkland and Joe Hammond, who many say was probably the best playground hoops player ever, against a collection of pros and college standouts that included Julius Erving. Dr. J's team was coached by sports columnist Pete Vesey. Again, author Vincent Malazzi.
Legend has it that Joe Hammond scored 50 points on the great Dr. J in a single half. He came late for the contest. That's been disputed and debated back and forth over the years. Peter Vesey told me that while Hammond may not have gotten 50 points in that game, he certainly scored somewhere in the 40s.
Holcomb Rucker died in 1965 at the age of 38. Were he alive today, he might not know what to make of the scene in the park that bears his name. For the last 20 years, the Entertainers Basketball Classic, or EBC as it's known, has featured playground ball with a lot of flash. No great surprise, given that this league was founded by rappers who pay players in the EBC. Greg Marius is the EBC's commissioner.
I think the quality of ball has changed and revolutionized basketball, period, from what we've been doing over 20 years.
While some might quibble with that assessment, no one can argue with the EBC's marketing chops. EBC games are carried on the NBA's satellite channel, and negotiations are underway with ESPN. A line of EBC sportswear has been manufactured for logo-hungry consumers, but far fewer NBA pros play now, and there are no great rivalries.
Look at the maniac. Oh, on the pass. No, no, no. Get it out of here. No, no, no. Get it out of here. No, 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 no.
Critics, especially the old-timers, say the EBC is more like the Harlem Globetrotters than the NBA.
It's more about dribbling behind your back, through your legs, throwing the alley-oop pass, a slam dunk.
65-year-old Cal Ramsey competed at Rucker in the 1950s and 60s and went on to play for New York University and the New York Knicks.
They do what they say they're going to do. They are the Entertainers Basketball League, and they do entertain. And they are very, very good basketball players, but they don't play great basketball. They play entertaining basketball.
Several referees from Rucker went on to officiate in the NBA. Lee Jones reffed NBA games from 1970 to 1996 and now supervises NBA officials. He says the playground players of today don't stand up to their counterparts at Rucker in the 1960s and 70s.
I don't think you can duplicate what we had back in those days. It's just not the same. It's a different breed of player. Today, they play in the playground, but not with that mystique that we had back in those days.
That mystique may not exist on the real asphalt anymore, but Hollywood is hoping to recreate it on the silver screen. This summer, director Malcolm Lee is shooting The Rucker in the park that bears Holcomb Rucker's name. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York. Oh,
oh, oh. You're listening to Only a Game. Sarah Wegman of Rochester, New York, emailed this week to say, I love your program, especially the more obscure and less publicized sports, like the story about recruiting luge athletes in last week's show. Judy Bishop emailed to compliment Nancy Greenlease for her story in last week's program, the race car drivers who went to the Olympic Training Center in Colorado and swam with the women triathlon contenders. Great stuff, she wrote. I can hardly wait for my alarm to go off so I can listen on Saturday morning. Wendell Peters of San Antonio, Texas, wrote to say that he didn't think we'd given the Spurs or their fans enough credit for being a class act during the NBA postseason. There are good teams west of the Mississippi, he contended, and we celebrate in a classy way. No riots, no looting, no fires. Jonathan Cassidy, who hears only a game on WAMC in Albany, emailed his dismay that neither our program nor any other program pays sufficient attention to the double segment of pro tennis tournaments. Listeners from New York, Philadelphia, and various points west as well suggested that in the future we should more thoroughly cover chess, rock climbing, and junior Olympic weightlifting. And finally, Macy Miller called the listener line to pose a question about an incident in a Boston-Detroit ball game he and his son saw in Fenway Park 33 years ago.
Morton for the Detroit Tigers hit a foul ball, and it went straight up in the air, and it hit a pigeon. And the pigeon circled and all the way down and landed on home plate dead. And the umpire called him out. Now, the reason why I'm calling you about this is if a ball is hit by an innocent pigeon, is that a spectator of the sport? And would that be a ground rule double?
You can leave an answer to that question or a message for us at 617-353-1860. You can contact us via email through our website, onlyagame.org. Postcards and letters will reach us at Only A Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway and a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In more of yesterday's interleague play, Atlanta toppled Tampa Bay 8-2. Kansas City stymied St. Louis 6-3. Milwaukee mauled Minnesota 13-1. Texas beat Houston 10-7, and Seattle stopped San Diego 8-2. Elsewhere, Anaheim blanked Los Angeles 3-0, and San Francisco shut out Oakland 6-0. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with Joe Queenan about the tragic inner life of sports fans. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a perusal of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
I'm burying myself in my own tragic inner life here.
That's hard
I'll carry
avoid,
on.
Isn't it? It is the morning after the morning after the NBA draft. Which general managers do we find still celebrating and which are feeling hungover?
The big winner, Bill? The Balkan economy, or the various economies of the various Balkan states. I think the your own home team, Boston Celtics, pulled a bold move by sort of doing one of those wonderful draft day nudge-nudge, wink-wink jobs with Jerry West and the Memphis Grizzlies, and getting the point guard they wanted in Marcus Banks from UNLV, and trading away hometown hero Troy Bell. Of course, there are a great number of people in the first round of the draft of whom I know absolutely nothing. Well, not being a regular reader of the various Balkan and French basketball magazines.
That's what I want to get to, because the recurring theme before the draft began was the invasion of numerous talented foreign players. But that didn't really play out quite the way a lot of people thought it would, especially for Polish seven-footer Macy Lampe.
No, he had a little contract complication. Lawyers from many lands working on it. No, there was only one foreign player picked in the top 10. That was Darko Milicic by Detroit in the second, which everybody expected. Chris Kaman and Chris Bosch, both native-born large people, of whom people had probably heard even less than they have heard of Darko Milicic coming into the draft, both made it. As the draft gets younger and more foreign, it gets more interesting by the year.
You have in your hands, as we speak, a 2004 mock draft, so let's not waste a single moment. Who do you think the Clippers will take a year from now?
Nobody. Actually, the 2004 mock draft that I have in my hand has the Clippers picking six, so they're predicting the Clippers will have a fairly good year. They have, unfortunately, they're rather less than confident on the whole LeBron James factor, since they seem to have Cleveland picking first again next year and taking Emeka Okafor, the power forward from UConn. But you see this 2004 mock draft, Bill? Listen very carefully.
Yeah, there it goes. Do we need some WAG to publish a 2025 mock draft for us to conclude
somewhere,
that the empire is, in fact, toppling?
Somewhere out there, both in cyberspace and his parents' attic, there's a sweaty guy wearing a pocket protector who's working on a 2024 mock draft.
Mm-hmm. Roy Tarpley was the seventh pick in the weird and tragic 1986 NBA draft, Charlie. He was supposedly banned for life in 1995 after thrice violating the league's substance abuse policy, but he recently applied for reinstatement. Does he return? And if so, what team takes a 37-year-old seven-footer?
He's 7 feet tall. He's 37 years old. Someone, by the end of the season, if he does manage to stay out of trouble and avoid lapsing back into his old ways, I believe we'll take a chance on Roy Tarpley if he's reinstated. He has the seal of approval from John Lucas, who's sort of the clearinghouse for this sort of problem in the NBA. Somebody will pick him up.
The Atlantic Coast Conference is finished with its mock draft and will apparently make its selections by Monday. Which universities will be embraced and which ones get stabbed in the back?
Well, the conference says that Miami and Virginia Tech are ready to go to the ACC. Miami's President Donna Shalala seems to be a little bit unclear about that still. There doesn't seem to be any question that the reason Virginia Tech is going is because of the lawsuit that was filed in the state of Virginia against the ACC. It also seems that the guy in the most untenable position is Boston College Athletic Director Gene DeFilippo, who now has to go back and try to do business with the other teams in the Big East that he was perfectly ready to publicly spurn in his attempt to leap to the ACC.
Just strikes me that the fact that this whole thing has dragged on so long and has been such a dirty, grim, secretive business, nobody can have any illusions anymore about the purity of college sports, it seems to me.
Well, I think, the problem is that there are a number of people in the business of college sports who will pretend they have the illusions of the purity of college sport, and that will keep genuine reform from ever happening.
There are rumors that Czech phenom and former Detroit Red Wings netminder Dominik Hasek may return to the National Hockey League. What do you think? Is he bored or in need of some place to go to avoid prosecution in his native country?
Well, I think he's looking around, and he's the only athlete in the Balkans who isn't making a ton of money in the United States right now, and here he comes. He was going to retire 4 years ago, but he changed his mind and went back to the Sabres, and then he went to the Wings and won the Stanley Cup and left the way you are, quote-unquote, supposed to leave.
At the top.
Now, it gets really complicated because the Detroit Red Wings, who own his rights, also have signed Curtis Joseph to a long-term contract. I'm not exactly sure what will happen. I mean, I think that the Red Wings can still get something for Dominik Hasek, who certainly, at the very least, is the last piece some teams need.
In the baseball acquisitions department, Mr. Todd McFarlane, identified as a comic book and action figure mogul, purchased Barry Bonds' 73rd home run at auction Wednesday, making Mr. McFarlane the owner of three of the world's seven most valuable baseballs. It's a distinction of sorts,
I
suppose. Come on,
Bill, give the guy his props. You never read Spawn? No teenage sons, obviously. Yeah, Todd McFarlane now has the 70th Mark McGwire home run, Sammy Sosa's 66th, the Barry Bonds 73, and what are his plans for these three little nuggets? I'll take a look at the ball and probably get a photo of all three of them together, and then we'll see if we can work something out with the Hall of Fame.
Finally, Charlie, Nathan Hobson, who hears only a game in Japan via the Internet, informs us that professional wrestler and lawmaker the great Sasuke has withstood a challenge from the Iwata Prefecture Assembly and will be allowed to wear his mask even despite his apparent involvement in an adult film, so justice prevails.
This was a tough one to spin, but and I don't see a real problem with this since there are more than a few people in Washington that think, oh, Tom DeLay should be made to wear a mask every time he comes to work.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. At one point in True Believers, subtitled The Tragic Inner Life of Sports Fans, writer Joe Queenan says, quote, "Sports has ruined the better part of my life." Elsewhere, he acknowledges that, quote, "I like pro football more than life itself because in my experience, pro football provides more thrills than life itself." Hence the quandary that drives this book and its author, who joins me now in the studio. Joe Queenan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
Early in True Believers, you establish a strict set of standards by which real fans must abide. And the list begins with never switch allegiances. So I gather that's the most important rule.
That's the single most important rule of them all. I've told my daughter, when you go out with a guy, if he was born in one place and roots for a team from another place, don't go out with him, because if he betrayed his team, he can easily betray you.
Direct correlation.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It just shows, it's all about moral character, and it just shows people who switch allegiances, people who move from Michigan to New York and root for the Yankees, lack moral fiber. There are people who are unwilling to play the cards they were dealt, and they're unwilling to take their medicine.
Your own misfortune was to be born with no option but to become a fan of the Philadelphia teams. But teams from lots of different places can ruin fans' lives, right, as long as the fans have what you would define as the proper attitude.
Yeah. And the thing is that in certain places, when you go to Chicago, for example, one of the things that makes being a White Sox fan so tragic is that they live in a town where people come from all over the country to see the Cubs. Everybody loves the Cubs because of Wrigley, of course, but also the Cubs are lovable because they're harmless. They're never a threat to win. Their uniforms are quite childish. They have those little bears on them and things like that. they have childish clothing, and they always lose, and people love them. Mm-hmm. And yet people don't love the White Sox, and people don't commiserate with the White Sox. People always say, oh, the poor Red Sox, oh, the poor Cubbies. And the White Sox have had as tragic a history as either of those teams. They say the Red Sox haven't won since 1918. The White Sox haven't won since 1917. And yet they are not in the first tier of national mythology, for whatever the reason.
Different fans have different definitions of great experiences at games, but you maintain that madness must prevail. Quote, supporters, delirious, crazed, immersed in a froth of psychopathic lunacy, that sort of thing. Have I got that about right?
Yeah. I think that that's one of the problems with regular season baseball is that nobody gets too worked up about it unless there's a brawl. It's just a very kind of sedate thing. People do deals. People have picnics. You see a lot of kids there. And that's one of the things that I like about professional football is by the time you get to late November, you're not seeing any kids at the games anymore. You don't see casual fans at December football games once it gets cold. And that's part of the thing that I like. I like the feeling of being united in a single emotion, probably in a hopeless cause. But I love that feeling of everybody standing up at the same time for the goal line stands. And you get it. If you go to football games in Europe, you really get that. English football fans have a very bad reputation, and in many cases it's justifiable. The Millwall fans are animals. The Manchester United fans are animals. But Arsenal, which is the team that was immortalized in Nick Hornby's book, Fever Pitch, if you go to an Arsenal game, the people swear for 2 hours at the other team, and it's very, very profane. But they're not actually louts. They're people who have adapted this loutish persona for the afternoon. I went to an Arsenal-Tottenham Hotspurs game with a graphic designer and with a woman who worked as a receptionist for the Institute of Contemporary Art. And these are not the people that you normally think of as soccer fans. And in fact, because of all the violence in the 80s, they raised the prices. So they priced the working class louts out of it. So what's happened is that the middle class fans come in there and behave like lower class people.
They assume the persona.
Yeah, it's like Marie Antoinette used to like to pretend to be a shepherdess. Yeah, you know, and that's basically like, it's sort of like Bill O'Reilly. Like, you know how Bill O'Reilly likes to pretend to be working class? And he grew up on Long Island and his father was an accountant. But there's this kind of Americans, Chris Berman's another guy. He went to private school in Tarrytown. Americans love to masquerade as working class people.
After talking about the idiots that sports fans must endure and the abuse and the self-loathing that comes with the territory, you conclude that, quote, there is nothing better to do with your time.
Yeah.
Is this a celebration of sports or are you just giving up on all the alternatives?
You know, there's a lot of other things that I like. Like, I would love to go this afternoon to see the Thomas Gainsborough exhibition, okay? But English painting of the 18th century just doesn't get my pulse going that fast. You know, I like to go to the opera. I like rock and roll is the closest thing to sport. But the difference between rock and roll and sport is when you're about 25, you stop believing that rock and roll can change your life. Because you grow up and you recognize that it's a business and that you have to get a job and that even though Bruce Springsteen sings all those songs about Jersey, he actually lives in Santa Monica. So there's a point at which rock and roll loses its ability to really rev you up. But sports doesn't.
Well, now that's fascinating to me because I would think that the same thing would happen vis-a-vis sports as you recognize that these guys aren't really representing their town or their city. They're mercenaries. They go wherever they're traded. They often say, I'll only go to such and such a team because I want to win a championship.
Right. And that's why I didn't write about athletes in the book, because what was of interest to me is if you go into a bookstore, there'll be hundreds and hundreds of books about athletes. At this point, I don't think that there's anything more about Michael Jordan that I need to learn. I mean, I know everything about him personally, and I saw him play for 20 years. So I know what he can do. I know what Babe Ruth could do. What's interesting is the phenomenon of the fans, because what the players never understand is the fans link everything to everything else that ever happens. If a ball goes between your legs in Boston, you will forever be linked with Buckner. If you drop a ball in center field in Philadelphia, oh, just like Maddox in 1978, those things are all part of this historical narrative. It's the only storyline that really runs through your entire life. And I think, you know, some people who aren't interested in sports have another storyline. I just don't.
Your relationship with sports, though, strikes me, having read the book, as profoundly complicated. because you say at one point, well, you know, you get into sports the same way you get into tobacco
right.
as a teenager, and it's a noxious habit, and you wish you could quit, but you can't. Would you quit if you could?
Sometimes that I think that I would. It's a little bit late now, but sometimes I wish that I could. The thing that happens is most kids get interested, most boys get interested in sports when they're about 13 or 14. Because they have grown up idolizing knights in shining armor, and then they start rooting for Notre Dame, or they start rooting for the University of Miami, or the Red Sox, or the Yankees, because they replace the knights in shining armor. Well, when I was 14, I had the double thing of the Phillies having this absolutely amazing season that no one expected, where it appeared that they would win the pennant, and then they had the most ignominious collapse in history. And I think that in the back of my mind, there's a sense that no matter how bad things get, nothing's going to be worse than 1964. You know, it's kind of the way, you know, people in Europe must have looked in throughout the Dark Ages. It's like, well, no matter how bad things get, they can't sack Rome again.
Joe Queenan is a contributing editor at GQ and the author of True Believers, The Tragic Inner Life of Sports Fans, published by Henry Holt. Joe, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
In the time of Attila the Hun, homes were torched until there were none. But villagers could always build another one. They knew there's always next year. The tax man knocks and says to pay. You thought you'd hold your money another day. What can you do but stand up and say, there's always next year.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or learn more about Joe Queenan's new book, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from former Detroit Tigers hurler and current broadcaster Jack Morris, who thinks even the greenest Tigers must know something about the team's history.
You're playing for Detroit. No, don't know Sparky. I think that's an automatic pass back home.
Well, yeah, but I don't see what Only a Game producer and cowgirl action shootist Karen Given has to do with baseball. Oh, you mean Sparky Anderson. Never mind. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. Next week, Pip and Ross will try to play Lou Gehrig to My Wally Pip. I'll see you the week after that.
When your team goes for the finish line, at the halfway point, they're doing fine. But in the end, they finished at the end of the line. There's always next year. There's always next year.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is
8 BICON.
This is